Europe is experiencing the largest wave of refugees since World War II and is desperate to find a long-term solution. Join America Abroad for a town hall discussion linking New York to Berlin on iTunes and PRI.org/America Abroad.
Obama and Netanyahu like oil and water today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Some say the U.S. president and Israeli prime minister don't mix well, but the stakes are high right now, especially in Jerusalem.
I never over-romanticized the city. I never thought we lived in a Scandinavian neighborhood, but the level of distrust and hatred, it's pretty grim.
Plus, ISIS takes to Twitter to mock Al-Qaeda's leaders.
Now, ISIS has no qualms about calling them actual names, to, you know, calling them old men, donkeys, and so they're very insulting.
And a new campaign teams up with Black Lives Matter to tackle caste violence in India.
Everywhere we go, the moment we talk about caste, nobody wants to talk about it.
Those stories and more coming up today here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could be here today. Let's kick off things with the meeting at the White House today between President Obama and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. For Mideast watchers, it's a kind of moment where you probably want to be a fly on the wall. For many Israelis, though, it's not something they need to know about because from their experience, another American attempt to restart the Mideast peace process right now is a non-starter.
People look at another round of negotiations under the United States as the equivalent of getting a floppy disk with Windows 95. And no matter how many times you poke it into the USB port, it's not going to reboot your laptop.
That's Israeli attorney and activist Daniel Seidemann. He says the analogy is not his. He got it from a Palestinian friend. According to Seidemann, expectations for any movement toward peace in the region are at an all-time low.
If I were to sum up a person on the street who is not engrossed in his coffee or making it through the day, it would be the goal of the meeting between Netanyahu and Obama is to make it through the meeting safely without a major blowout.
Wow, well, that's setting the bar really low.
Oh, expectations are really low. The Palestinians are knee-deep in despair, and Israelis are knee-deep in denial. We're sipping cappuccino on the edge of a volcano. I think that a good deal of successful delegitimization of President Obama has taken place. His ratings in Israel is low. He's perceived, I think, very incorrectly as not being a friend of Israel. But even if he were perceived more favorably, Israelis do not believe in the accessibility of a political process. Now, that doesn't mean that the United States is not important. They're not important as a political broker.
So tell me about one specific place in East Jerusalem. Take us to that neighborhood and what people there today are feeling.
Look, I'm an Israeli, and I think it would be paternalistic for me to describe what they're undergoing. But allow me to take you to the neighborhood of Isawiya. I was just there. It's opened up a bit. The checkpoints are there. Cars are allowed in and out through one checkpoint throughout the neighborhood.
And this is East Jerusalem, so these are Palestinians, correct?
These are Palestinians. But when I was there last week, the neighborhood was completely sealed. And that means that you could enter and exit through a checkpoint only by foot, not by vehicular traffic. Now, neither we Israelis nor our Palestinian neighbors have been blessed with Scandinavian temperaments. I have no illusions. There have been a significant number of terrorists who came out of Isawiya. But we have imposed collective punishment on 14 or 15,000 people and basically said, you are all suspect and you're all guilty. And until you no longer have terrorists emerging from your midst, we're going to punish all of you. Now, those barriers are now coming down. But after having heard so loud and so clear, you, the residents of Isawiya, are an alien, hostile population. Are we Israelis entitled to be surprised when we discover that they're acting in a way that it is both alienated and hostile? hatred in Jerusalem has been more popularized, more endemic than any time that I can remember in the 43 years that I've been living here.
I suspect there were Israelis who were pretty glad that the net around that neighborhood was very finely meshed for a while.
Both sides of the city are scared. My Palestinian friends work in the local cafe, are throwing out the trash in couples because they're sometimes afraid to go out alone. Neither side knows how scared the other side is. There's very, very little empathy. And there's an element of a tribal conflict in this. Each side wants to inflict as much pain on the other as is possible. And that's not the Jerusalem I knew. I never over-romanticized the city. I never thought we lived in a Scandinavian neighborhood. But the level of distrust and hatred, it's pretty grim.
Israeli attorney Daniel Seideman, who directs Terrestrial Jerusalem. That's an NGO that he founded. Mr. Seideman, thank you very much.
Pleasure's mine.
That mistrust between Israelis and Palestinians that Seideman just described is not just palpable in Jerusalem. This next story is about a Palestinian man who lives in Tel Aviv, and he's gained sudden fame in Israel, as we hear in this report from Rebecca Collard.
In the past 3 weeks, Ziad Abulhawa has received dozens of media requests. The 28-year-old Palestinian has become famous in Israel, not for some grainy image of a knife attack. It's because he took a selfie next to a racist note left by one of his neighbors in his apartment block in central Tel Aviv.
With what's happening lately here, somebody put a note about there is an Arab living in the building, and with the current situation, we cannot be indifferent about it, and we need to sit down all together and check him out and to see if he's legit, basically.
Of course, that Arab was Abulhawa, and he'd been living in this building for years. So what did he do?
And I took a selfie, of course, and I put it on my Facebook.
Abulhawa's friends started sharing his selfie, and soon it had over 6,000 likes and 500 comments on Facebook.
And then at the beginning, I was like laughing at it with my friends, and it was fun. And then like random people that I don't know started sharing, and like within an hour, I don't know how, but almost every TV channel or TV program and newspaper in Israel knew my phone for some reason. And then the phone didn't stop ringing, like, for hours.
Overwhelmed by the attention, Abulhawa decided to do just one television interview.
Zizo Shalom.
Shalom, guy.
Here, he's being interviewed by Israel's Channel 10. The host says, listen, we're laughing about this now, but I'm sure you felt bad at the time. It's not fun when you think you've built this bubble and this good life and someone can pop it, Abulhawa replies in near perfect Hebrew. But what can I do but laugh about it? There's nothing typical about Abulhawa. He was born in Spain to a Palestinian father from East Jerusalem and a Palestinian mother who was born a refugee in Syria. When he was 9 years old, just after the signing of the Oslo Peace Accords, Abulhawa's family returned to East Jerusalem. When he was 19 years old, Abulhawa moved to Tel Aviv. He now works at an insurance company and lives in a predominantly Jewish area. And he lives as an openly gay man. Earlier this year, he married his Jewish-Israeli boyfriend, though it's unofficial, as there's no same-sex or interfaith marriage performed in Israel. It's possible that Abulhawa's neighbor never would have known there was a Palestinian living in the building, except that 2 years ago, Abulhawa put his distinctly Arab name on his mailbox. Before that, he says, the mailman didn't even deliver his mail.
Probably the mail poster. Don't think there's an Arab living in this building as well, so.
It's not that common for Palestinians and Jews to live in the same building in Israel. Most of the population lives in separate communities, despite the fact that around 20% of the country's citizens are Palestinian. Abulhawa says this wasn't the first time he's faced discrimination or racial profiling in Israel.
Of course, in airports, I always get the Arab treatment. Like, you're a terrorist until you prove otherwise.
Abulhawa says that Jewish Israelis often don't realize he's Palestinian.
People keep saying, like, you don't look like an Arab, like it's a compliment.
But the note was probably the most personal attack he's had. The neighbor, who didn't give a name, called for a meeting on October 15th to discuss the situation and decide what can be done. Abulhawa says in this case, his neighbors and other Jewish Israelis came to his defense. On October 15th, hundreds of people, alerted by Facebook, showed up at a rally in his name in a square nearby. Meanwhile, the room in his building where the meeting was supposed to take place was locked. So far, there's been no attempt to reschedule it, and no word from the anonymous neighbor. Abu Hawa says he still can't get over all the attention his selfie is generating online and in the media.
People are dying in the streets. That's the only thing that you have to put on TV.
For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard, Tel Aviv.
History in the making for Myanmar. The results of yesterday's Burmese elections are not yet official, but the opposition party led by Aung San Suu Kyi is claiming victory. Reports suggest her National League for Democracy could end up with a big majority in parliament. This is extraordinary in a country that, until not too long ago, was ruled through oppression by a military junta. And the military remains a powerful force in Burma, so the transition to democracy is still in a delicate phase. I got an update earlier today from Patrick Nguyen in Yangon. He's with our partners at Global Post.
The mood in Yangon is pretty euphoric. As you walk around town, you see lots of people with ink-stained pinkies, which is an indication that they voted. I think people are pretty ecstatic that they were even given the ability to vote and that it looks like the results of the vote for now are being accepted.
Yeah, so when you go around and you speak with people, what are they telling you? Why are they excited and why did they vote?
I'm hearing from a lot of people that voting was a very cathartic experience. You know, life in Myanmar can be pretty dehumanizing. The military has, for decades, pushed people around, told them what to think, censored their news, stolen their land. The list goes on. So people feel fairly powerless in this country, and I think the election has given them this slight feeling that they had a say in who runs the place, and that's been very cathartic.
Still, Burma is in a state of transition, and it is a complex political system. With the expected win of Aung San Suu Kyi and her party, will they actually be able to govern?
They certainly will, but with certain restrictions. The military set up this election so that all their power wouldn't just be flushed away. They still have broad authority over warfare, which is still going on in the hills. They have broad authority over certain cabinet positions, such as who controls the police force. They even have put in a restriction in the constitution that prevents Aung San Suu Kyi, who is perhaps the most famous person ever from Myanmar, from becoming president herself. So they will have a role in picking the president, although that person will also have to be amenable to Aung San Suu Kyi herself. So they still have a ton of power.
So give us a reality check, Patrick, with uncertainty over how Aung San Suu Kyi and her pro-democracy party will be able to lead and what the people who voted for her expect her to do. I mean, what's going to happen?
Well, here's the reality check. Whoever runs this country next is going to have to deal with a lot of problems. We're talking civil war, anti-Muslim bigotry, refugees, probably some angry generals, child labor, the list goes on. Running Myanmar is just about the hardest job in the world. So the next person that takes control will have their work cut out for them. I think everyone knows that moving forward, it's going to be difficult. There's so many problems to solve. But now they're in sort of a happy afterglow period. Everyone in Myanmar is sort of in a mood to party, and after all they've been through, they really deserve it.
So with an 80% turnout, I understand, and lots of pink ink on fingers around Burma, was this the pink pinky revolution?
Well, it's not being called that on the street, but there's an interesting phenomenon going on. People have smartphones in Myanmar now, which is quite odd considering that 5 years ago, the military completely controlled the way people talk to each other, completely controlled the media. Those restrictions have been lifted, and people are allowed to use Facebook, allowed to use Instagram, and they're making the best of it by putting up selfies of them holding up their ink-stained fingers. So I can even imagine a situation in which the electoral turnout was heightened because people wanted to get that ink-stained finger. It's kind of a cool thing to have as you're walking around Yangon right now.
Patrick Nguyen with our partners at Global Post. He's in Yangon in Burma. Thanks so much, Patrick, for the update.
Thanks a lot, Marco.
If you'd like to know what it was like to vote in Burma's first free election in decades, we've got one voter's story at PRI.org. Also, just ahead on the program, why someone set fire to the door of Russia's main security agency. This is The World.
Support for The World comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com. Grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. If you've been out and about in Moscow's Lubyanka Square early today, you would have seen something really unusual. A Russian performance artist set fire to the main doors of the Russian security agency, the FSB. Then this man was arrested. It's all on video, too, and it was posted online later. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. Tell me about this protest, his art, his stunt. I don't even know what to call it.
Well, so Pyotr Pavlensky, he's a 30-year-old artist from St. Petersburg, and this isn't the first time he's done sort of very political art, I guess, that they've grabbed headlines here and around the world. You might recall a few years ago, it was during the Pussy Riot trial, he did a stunt in St. Petersburg, which got him a lot of notoriety at the time. He sewed his mouth shut, basically to oppose the trial of the Pussy Riot members that was going on in Moscow. Then there was an even more famous stunt he pulled off just a few years ago, was he nailed his scrotum to Red Square. So he's kind of a master of these sort of one-time political street acts of art, and certainly most of his work is tailored to the themes of police state and oppression in contemporary Russia.
Yeah, wow. Guy really takes it to the limit. So I can only imagine what would happen if somebody did this at Langley CIA headquarters. What's been the reaction in Russia? Is it making headlines? It's got to be.
Well, it's an internet sensation for sure. The state media hasn't covered much of it, but certainly on the internet, you've seen a lot of coverage. And it should be said that he's facing now criminal charges. They've put him down for essentially vandalism, and he's facing up to 3 years. But in fact, he also has another standing criminal case against him for the Scrotum on Red Square Act. So I think he sort of invites controversy, and certainly he's found it once again.
I mean, Pussy Riot going into that Russian Orthodox Church a couple of years ago, that was labeled hooliganism. Is he linked with Pussy Riot?
Well, no, he's part of sort of a diverse scene of punk street performance art that's in Russia with very heavy political overtones. Pussy Riot, as you mentioned, was obviously probably the most famous. And it's interesting that Nadia Tolokolnikova, who's a very well-known member of Pussy Riot, you know, referred to Mr. Pavlensky as essentially the brains, conscience, and balls of the era. So, you know, he's captured the zeitgeist.
Apparently so. Does this form of activism, does it resonate with the average Russian?
I don't know that it does at this point, because I think a lot of the average Russians probably don't get to hear about it. They certainly don't hear it, see it on state television. And I think it's also important to point out that when Pussy Riot became such sort of a big scandal here, it was at a certain moment when the opposition movement was very strong in Russia. It played on people's sort of traditional sense of values and what they approved and didn't approve of. Mr. Pavlensky seems to kind of operate a little bit further afield. You know, there isn't a strong opposition movement right now. I think, in fact, if you look at what Pyotr Pavlensky was trying to do today, was sort of wake up society. And he said as much in a statement that he released online.
Yeah. So what does this tell us right now about dissatisfaction with Putin and Russia, Charles? Still a thing, but without a strong opposition movement, not a real big thing.
I mean, the problem with the opposition right now is it's completely fragmented. We've seen that after the annexation of Crimea, which sort of divided people over this idea of whether they were for or against annexation. But I think Pavlensky has always kind of kept his focus on one thing, which is the idea of sort of a police state of oppression. And he just kind of hits the same note again and again, but he does it very effectively. And I think he really is such an internet phenomenon. I mean, these are one-off acts that are essentially designed to be photographed. And the images are stunning if you look for them online, as he sort of stands holding a canister of gasoline in front of the KGB headquarters. I mean, it looks like something out of a Hollywood film. So I think his goal is to wake things up, and frankly, things haven't been. You know, most of the opposition has been very subdued over the last several years.
Yeah, they're one-off acts, but they go viral. What's going to happen to Pavlensky?
Well, he faces a possible 3-year sentence. It's really hard to say whether the authorities are going to decide to sort of prosecute him to the fullest, or if they think this will just bring sort of unwanted attention to Mr. Pavlensky. I mean, he's clearly a very smart artist, and he has very serious intentions, and I think it's a question of whether they want to essentially give them credence.
Our friend, reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you for your time today, Charles.
Thank you, Marco.
One of the perks of being president of this country is you get to pick the ambassadors to represent the U.S. around the globe. But before an ambassador can fly off to wherever, Congress has to approve. Most nominees are career diplomats, and they often cruise through the process. A few, though, are political appointments, and that can lead to delays. Right now, Congress has snarled things up to such a degree that more than 30 countries are without U.S. ambassadors. And many of those nominated but not yet confirmed are career diplomats. That's unusual, says Tomika Tilleman of the New America Foundation. He's a former staffer with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, where he used to help vet ambassadorial candidates.
This is rather unprecedented, and I think it's also rather unfortunate. There have historically been many occasions when political appointees, for a variety of reasons, have run into roadblocks in the course of the confirmation process. But it's extremely unusual for career ambassadors and career diplomats to run into challenges over the course of confirmation. And it's even less common to have a whole raft of nominees run into these challenges. So this is very, very uncommon.
So what's going on? What's a holdup? Take us down the career diplomat road first, and then just kind of generally, what's the slowdown all about?
Well, I think you have a couple of different dynamics. And again, to get to the bottom of this, you would ultimately have to ask the senators involved. There are accusations that some of the nominees that have been put before the committee are in some ways linked to policies that various members of the Senate find unpalatable. And so that's part of the holdup. But in many instances, there doesn't even seem to be much of an explanation based on substance. And rather, the delay is being used as a tactic to attempt to inflict damage on an administration that some in the Senate don't like. And this is unfortunate for a variety of reasons. First, at a practical level, it really impedes the work of embassies on the ground. And there have been many occasions, both when I was in the Senate and also when I was at the State Department, when I would arrive in a country and hear the ambassador, the representative in charge, the chargé, say that in the absence of an ambassador, he or she just couldn't do the work that the United States needed to have performed on the ground in order to advance our interests. The second issue really goes to our credibility in the world. And this is a challenge that we face, and that to the extent we delay in appointing these ambassadors, in many countries, that's seen as a message that we don't take the relationship seriously. And over time, that can do real damage in terms of our ability to cooperate with another government.
Is there any executive action the White House can take on this?
There is a little used ability that the president has to make interim appointments, what are called recess appointments. That ability has been complicated in recent years due to some changes in the rules and the way that the Senate convenes. So the president, at least theoretically, can appoint an ambassador to serve for a limited period of time in the absence of Senate confirmation. And that may solve the problem of having somebody on the ground. It does not, however, address the bigger challenges that this problem poses to U.S. credibility in the world. I remember one example very vividly when I was in Tunisia a few years ago and meeting with a group of parliamentarians there. And they told me amid riotous laughter that a delegation of U.S. representatives from our Congress had come to them and lectured them at length about the importance of working across party lines and the importance of building coalitions. Now, the advice that they were providing was very, very sound, but the laughter, of course, was generated by the failure to practice those principles in our own legislative bodies. Mm. And that damage, unfortunately, persists even in the presence of a recess appointment.
To Micah Tilleman, Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation, thanks for your time today.
My great pleasure.
The ISIS affiliate in Sinai and what it is capable of, that's coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Lila Kajdin always had a dream.
When I was about 8 years old, I said to my grandmother, my bubby, I want to be a rabbi when I grow up. And my bubby said, that is not a good job for a nice Jewish girl.
But she stuck with it, went to rabbinical school, and now she's been ordained. Rabbi Kajdin, ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International and by Soundworks.org, offering perspectives on events and cultures around the globe with the World's Daily Podcast and the Studio 360 Podcast. Subscribe at Soundworks.org or iTunes.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Investigators are still trying to figure out what brought down that Russian Metrojet airliner in Sinai in Egypt last week. But increasingly, officials are saying it's possible it was a terrorist bomb. Some would even say likely. And under that scenario, suspicion falls squarely on the ISIS affiliate in the Sinai Peninsula. For more on that, we turn to journalist Mohamed Sabri. He's written about the Sinai Peninsula and security issues there.
There's one main militant group in Sinai. It has become the umbrella for the terrorist attacks and terrorist operations in the Sinai Peninsula. And many of the operations that happened in mainland Egypt and the capital, Cairo, And if this is a bomb on board, as we are afraid it will be, this will mean that the terrorist organization operating in Sinai is still intact, fully capable of running covert operations, and is taking its level of hostility and level of terrorism to another extent that we have not witnessed before.
And this militant group on the Sinai Peninsula, this is, you identify them as the Sinai affiliate of ISIS?
It's not an affiliate. It's actually a recognized branch, which is rarely happening, that there are so many groups that pledge allegiance and claim affiliation, but it's rarely that ISIS's command in Syria and Iraq recognize a branch and give it an official name, which is what happened with Ansar Bayt al-Maqdis, that pledged allegiance and then became the Sinai province of the Islamic State.
So when did they pledge allegiance to ISIS, and how much do they actually follow the kind of political ideology line of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the ISIS leader?
They have been following the line for months and months before they pledged allegiance in mid-2014. They have used the same bloody, the same terrifying ways of ISIS, beheading people in care on videos, kidnappings and assassinations of community figures, continuous hostile, sophisticated attacks against the military and the police forces. And they finally, in 2014, they pledged allegiance to ISIS. How much coordination they have is a very complicated matter. It is extremely difficult to follow, but there is definitely very clear coordination in terms of media, propaganda, recruitment, and the capabilities of the group are just continue to prove themselves over and over again.
So what is it, Mohanad, about Sinai that it's this kind of fertile region for extremists?
Sinai is just like every other country that had domestic terrorism flare-ups. It's like Yemen, it's like Afghanistan, it's like Pakistan. I can give you a dozen examples that were pretty very similar to the case in Sinai. It's a marginalized region. The population, the native community is underprivileged. It is left out of the government's care and plans. And you have to understand that Sinai has been a very major arms trafficking route between Africa and the Gaza Strip. It's right beside the Israeli border, a very hostile zone. And it has witnessed so many wars between Egypt and Israel. And the Egyptian regime has never truly paid any attention to it, despite the fact that this Sinai Peninsula is the cornerstone of the Camp David Peace Accords. It's surrounded from both sides by the Israeli border and the Suez Canal, which are both extremely sensitive matters to the whole world, not only to Egypt.
Now with the Sharm el-Sheikh tragedy, doesn't the Egyptian government have to pay attention to Sinai?
Well, the Egyptian government should have paid more attention to Sinai decades ago. But speaking of the very recent history, everyone has been calling on the Egyptian regime to overhaul its policies, to start focusing on societal solutions and economic solutions beside the heavy-handed security and military campaign that it's adopting there. Now, you have to understand that in autocratic regimes and in very rigid bureaucratic dictatorships like the Egyptian regime currently, it's extremely difficult to convince the institutions of adopting modern, developed, and objective solutions.
Journalist Mohanad Sabri is the author of Sinai, Egypt's Lynchpin, Gaza's Lifeline, Israel's Nightmare. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We've known for some time that ISIS is active online. The group uses social media very effectively to try to recruit new fighters and to rail against its enemies like the U.S. and Russia and its chief rival in jihadi circles, Al-Qaeda. Yep, both ISIS and Al-Qaeda want to dominate the world in terrifying ways, just not together. In fact, they trade insults back and forth online in a tone more like school kids dissing each other. Patrick Skinner follows both organizations for the Sufan Group.
Yeah, it's really childish. And actually, Al-Qaeda is trying to play up that notion that ISIS is the spoiled brat. And they use those terms, child. They try to be more condescending than insulting, while ISIS, their actual statements from their spokesmen and from their official media mirror what their supporters do online. They dominate Twitter because Twitter is perfect for snark, and Islamic State kind of embraces that. And they take that same approach toward Al-Qaeda. And so, revered figures like Ayman Zawahiri or the spokesman al-Batarfi, who's a Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula spokesman. These are revered figures in Al-Qaeda. And ISIS has no qualms about calling them actual names, you know, calling them old men, donkeys. And so they're very insulting. Al-Qaeda tries to pivot that back and say, you know, just kind of look condescendingly and say, look what they're doing. Please stop. They don't threaten them.
So let's back up a little, Patrick, because ISIS began as Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Abu Musab Zarqawi, the leader. He had known connections to Al-Qaeda. How did these two groups become rivals?
Well, they tried to establish a presence in Syria. A couple of years ago, Baghdadi sent a small group into Syria to basically form ISIS in Syria. That was the last S. And then it quickly fell apart because Jolani, the leader of that small group, pledged allegiance to Zarqawi, the head of Al-Qaeda, while Baghdadi was demanding that that group be subordinate to him. And so it became an allegiance issue. And it, what became an allegiance issue became a turf battle and then a real battle.
So you were in the CIA. You're a good person to answer this. I mean, my understanding is that the narrative is that Al-Qaeda had grown weaker, splintered off, inspired other groups, and had not staged any of its signature attacks since 9/11, not to the same degree as 9/11 anyway. And ISIS simply climbed into the breach. What's wrong with that narrative, especially right now?
Well, that's a pretty accurate narrative, but you have to think of Al-Qaeda in several parts and ISIS in several parts. Al-Qaeda Central, the core group, the main people that we all know, yes, they were kind of pigeonholed into Afghanistan and Western Pakistan along the border, and they couldn't launch their attacks, which they always wanted. They want to call them the spectaculars. They could never get back to another 9/11, but their affiliates have done rather well. AQAP in Yemen is their most lethal affiliate, and then the Syrian civil war happens, Iraq fell apart. There is a misunderstanding that AQI or Al-Qaeda in Iraq was gone, and then the U.S. troops left, and they, you know, all of a sudden came back. That's false. Al-Qaeda never really left Iraq, and they never really left Afghanistan and Pakistan. They were just kind of, you know, latent. And then as the conditions worsened, all the extremists are doing well.
So your notion that Al-Qaeda is actually more resilient than ISIS, is that just because they have this philosophy that seems to have gotten picked up by a lot of people? Or do you think they're really kind of behind the scenes thinking, how can we be wily? How can we be resilient?
Yeah, I think it's not a matter of ideology, because ISIS and AQ share the exact same ideology. They share bin Ladenism. It's just a matter of style and allegiance that divides them. I say that AQ is more resilient. One, they've been around longer, much longer. But also, they don't try to hold territory. They try to form local alliances. They exist within a community. And so you can think of them more as a cancer, while ISIS is more of an infection. They come from the outside. There are a lot of foreign fighters, and they try to hold territory. And once you hold something, you know, then somebody can come take it away. Al-Qaeda refuses to declare a caliphate because they know they're not strong enough, and it would be devastating to lose a caliphate. And now eventually, I don't know when, but Mosul is going to be retaken, and Raqqa in Syria is going to be retaken, and ISIS will have lost a caliphate. Al-Qaeda doesn't want to do that. So they just prefer to play the long game, while ISIS is exactly like they are on social media, really brash and rash thinking.
There is growing consensus, Patrick, that the Russian metro jet that took off from Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt was brought down by a bomb. There's also speculation that ISIS somehow put it there. If that were true, what would the impact be in jihadist circles?
Well, it would kind of negate one of Al-Qaeda's main arguments against ISIS. They keep saying, hey, ISIS, you're killing Muslims. You're fighting us instead of attacking the far enemy, the West. And if ISIS did this, then ISIS can say, hey, we've actually taken along, you know, an attack at the most hated, I mean, even more than the U.S., Russia is really hated by jihadists for a long, long time. And so they can claim with credibility, we just did the biggest civilian airliner attack since 9/11 ourselves, and AQ hasn't done anything. So it'll rejuvenate them at a time where we were hoping that they were going to run out of a little momentum.
Patrick Skinner with the Sufan Group telling us about the rivalry between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
You're more than welcome.
In India, there's a group of people known as Dalits. Dalits were once called untouchables, the lowest rung on the traditional caste system. Imagine the discrimination. And for Dalit women, they're the ones who suffer the most. According to India's National Crime Records Bureau, the top two crimes last year against lower caste people were sexual assault and rape. A new campaign in India is trying to tackle caste violence by connecting with activist movements like Black Lives Matter here in the U.S. Sonia Paul has our story, and I should warn you, it contains some descriptions that some listeners will find disturbing.
Four women from the All India Dalit Women's Rights Forum sit at the front of a student lounge at the University of Texas at Austin. They've been on the road now for almost 2 months. The group they represent has a national office in Delhi, with about 15 part-time staff throughout India's states. They spent a long time fundraising to make this tour possible. The women speak to a group of around 30 students. First, they have to explain India's 3,000-year-old history with the caste system, especially untouchability. It's a practice of upper caste people not touching anything that has come into physical contact with Dalits. The practice is now outlawed, but the activists say its history still leads to everything from discrimination to outright crimes against Dalit people, especially against women and girls. And they're here to tell those stories, like this one.
She was like a 12-year-old girl who was raped by 16 men.
This happened about 3 years ago. Activist Sangapali Aruna Lohitakshi says the rapists actually filmed their crime.
And then they took the footage of the rape and then circulated in the whole village so that she will be humiliated, her family will be humiliated, and she will not be sent to the school. After the footage was shown to the family members, the father committed suicide.
It's the kind of incident so horrible that some people, both in India and in the U.S., might not believe it. Video is forcing the U.S. public to contend with police brutality against blacks. In the same way, mounting evidence in India can make the truth about caste violence much more apparent. Still, Lohitakshi says, prejudice against Dalits is so pervasive in India, even video is not always enough.
This girl took this footage as an evidence in the courtroom to show that she was raped, gang raped. And then the judge said, he laughed out loud and he said, "Wow, we know you enjoyed the act and you should be glad they touched you."
In this case, the Dalit woman activist helped the girl move to another village, where she now lives with her grandmother. She's enrolled in school there, but the lack of justice in her case is all too typical, they say. And so is reluctance to talk about the problem of caste violence at all.
Everywhere we go, the moment we talk about caste, nobody wants to talk about it.
The Dalit women see a parallel between this discomfort at home and discomfort here around race. A big reason they raised money to come here was to swap strategies with U.S. activists. In San Francisco, they spoke at the Women's Building with members of Black Lives Matter and Say Her Name. Say Her Name is a movement that emerged earlier this year to draw attention to the issues black women, trans, and queer people face. Brianna Gibson is a movement leader in the Bay Area.
So someone's saying, you know, we're post-caste versus like post-racial. We're like, wow, that's exactly the same thing. Or they'll tell you that, you know, you're being divisive and all of these other things. And even the treatment and how pervasive it is just in everyday life.
The exchange between the two groups was at times emotional, but also really educational, Gibson told the audience.
I know in my experience growing up in D.P. Stokely, everybody who was South Asian or Asian in general were wealthy people in my mind, because that's what I was taught. That they all came here as tech workers, right? And that they didn't understand our struggle. Well, obviously, we've been lied to.
So when it comes to the Indian population, for instance, the activists encourage people to de-Brahmify their minds and look beyond stereotypes. Brahmin is the name of the highest caste of Hindus, people who've historically had more advantages.
Are you ready?
They ended by asking audience members to join the Dalit women in their chant, whose words translate to "Long live Dalit woman's power."
Dalit Mahila Shakti Zindabad!
Zindabad! Zindabad!
And then they all sang a historic civil rights song in both English and in Hindi together.
We shall overcome someday.
Now for the Dalit women activists, it's back to India. They have a lot of difficult work ahead of them, but they say being in the U.S. gave them fresh energy and ideas and a lot of support. What they want to do now is train more women back home to continue to raise their voices. For The World, I'm Sonia Paul in San Francisco.
This is The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. two rabbis walk into a bar. This is not a joke. It's actually a little test. When I said that, did you picture two men or women? One woman, at least? The truth is, there are lots of female rabbis here in the U.S., and that's because the more liberal traditions in Judaism have been ordaining women rabbis since the 1970s. For Orthodox Jews, though, it's a very different story. From the World's Religion Desk, here's Matthew Bell.
I've heard the same line now from several different people, and it goes like this. Everybody knows Orthodox Jewish women can't be rabbis. To address any confusion on this point, the Rabbinical Council of America has made it official. That's a group of leading Orthodox rabbis here in the U.S. And about a week ago, the RCA declared that the title of rabbi is for men only. The decision does not sit well with Talia Lakritz, so she issued a spirited response on YouTube.
I think that women's Talmud Torah is a significant achievement, as long as they don't achieve too much.
Lakritz is an intern at Yeshivat Maharat. It's an Orthodox rabbinical school located in the Bronx that ordains women. It was founded in 2009. Graduates go on to do lots of rabbi stuff. They serve at synagogues and give sermons. They preside over rituals. They work as counselors and teachers. But most grads have decided not to take on the formal title of rabbi. Not all, though.
My name is Rabbi Lila Kasdan.
You're really a rabbi.
I really am.
When I mentioned this morning in the newsroom that I was working on a story about Orthodox women rabbis, one of my Jewish colleagues turned and said, that's an oxymoron.
Well, I would say the title rabbi might be a bit surprising and might feel new, but actually women have been in leadership roles in the Orthodox community for many, many years and really have been empowered in many ways throughout Jewish history.
And that goes back to women mentioned in the Bible, she says. As for herself, Kasdan grew up in Canada in a very religious family. As a kid, she sat with her father in the men's section of the congregation and says she loved Jewish learning.
When I was about 8 years old, I said to my grandmother, my bubby, my father's mother, I want to be a rabbi when I grow up. And my bubby said, that is not a good job for a nice Jewish girl. And
not even possible.
Not even possible. And I thought, well, but in every other area of my life, you tell me that I can do whatever I want. The expectations for me are that I go to the best universities and that I am a citizen of this world in every conceivable way. Why is this off the table?
This should not be a surprise to anyone.
Rabbi Gil Student blogs about Judaism at TorahMusings.com. He says the Rabbinical Council of America made the right decision when it prohibited the title of rabbi for Orthodox women.
This is really the lack of a change. It's following a traditional view. The ordination of women is something that traditionally has not been done. And this recent RCA decision is really just a continuation of that tradition.
Rabbi Student says Orthodox leaders recognize that the role of women has changed throughout history and that Orthodox Judaism is finding new ways for women to be religious leaders. But if women want to call themselves rabbi, he says, that means they're not really Orthodox Jews anymore. Interestingly, in Israel, Orthodox women have more freedom when it comes to rabbinical ordination. Several women have been ordained quietly by religious authorities in recent years. And this past summer, a yeshiva in Jerusalem granted two Orthodox women graduates the formal title of rabbi. Mish Hammer Kosoy is one of them.
Many people make a joke because everyone knows that a woman can't be an Orthodox rabbi. But people are so happy and people have really welcomed it. And I've been overwhelmed by people who turn to me with halachic questions, with legal questions, advising with me as a rabbi. So I feel that my services have already been utilized much more than I had ever dreamed.
As for Lila Kasdan, she says she's gotten a lot of encouragement since the latest round of controversy with the RCA. Even a few Orthodox rabbis, she says, have given her private words of support. She hopes they'll be brave enough to go on the record at some point. But for the time being, Rabbi Kasdan argues that the door is open and it's going to stay open.
Women's ordination will continue. This RCA resolution, I think it has motivated us all to really continue our work and move forward.
For the World, I'm Matthew Bell. We wrap things up today with a crazy mix between Pantsula and jazz. Pantsu what, I hear you say? Hang on just a sec, I'll explain. First, the jazz. This is British jazz band Sons of Kemet. Call their sound Afro-Futurist Jazz, and this is their new track, In the Castle of My Skin. You might recognize that as the title of the 1953 novel by George Lamming from Barbados. That is another story, literally. This story is about Pantsula and why it's important to this music by Sons of Kemet. For the video for In the Castle of My Skin, Sons of Kemet got a South African filmmaker on the job. Lebogang Rasathaba is his name, and he heard something in this music that reminded him of a dance style that's been part of South African culture since the 1950s. It's called, you guessed it, Pantsula. When apartheid-era South Africa forced blacks into townships, Pantsula became a form of expression and protest. Men taking to the streets in dance showdowns. The movements had hints of old vaudeville and tap dance. But even then, Pantsula foreshadowed the aggressive pop and lock moves that Michael Jackson would popularize years later. So Rasathaba scouted around and turned a vacant lot in the Johannesburg township of Tembisa into a dance floor. There's a cutting-edge dance school in Joburg called the Indigenous Dance Academy. They provided the very cool and talented dancers in black tie. Pantsula has gone through a couple of iterations since the apartheid era. This new one for the Sons of Kemet video puts it in the kind of jarring context of British jazz, but it works. Afrofuturism from Sons of Kemet. We've got the video for that track, In the Castle of My Skin, at our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/PRI the world. I'm Marco Werman, coming to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Rose Family Fund, by the United States Japan Foundation, the Plowshares Fund, a global security foundation working to build a world where nuclear weapons will never be used again, by the PRI Ambassador Council, including Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Ann Cerisi, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.